Autumn Shadows in August by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. If you would like to order a PDF download or trade paperback copy, go to www.lulu.com/Robert Norris. Autumn Shadows in August is also available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online bookstores. His image merged with Peter's and the journey that led me to him. My thoughts returned to the moment of the red balloon in the Nevada desert. I could visualize it clearly. 1973, 2 years out of military prison, knowing I have to leave the U.S. if I'm ever to find my niche in life. I'm hitchhiking across California, and one driver drops me off maybe 20 miles outside of Reno before turning off the main highway to head toward a town called Fernley. I stand there watching the last of the car's dust trail settle behind it, then turn back to head east again. The Nevada desert stretches in all directions, a mixture of auburn wasteland, rolling tumbleweeds, and splotches of unmelted snow. In the far distance are the Rockies, their snow-topped peaks forming a jagged spine barely discernible on the horizon. I look at the expanse of sky, and there, out of the largest cloud, a tiny red dot appears. As it drifts in my direction, it becomes increasingly larger, until finally distinguishable. A child's red balloon with a long white string attached to it. I stand transfixed, staring at it, watching it come closer and touch down just opposite me on the other side of the highway. A gust of wind picks it up, carries it directly to the base of my feet, and lays it there to rest. I bend down and pick it up. It's impossible, yet entirely natural, that it should settle right there in the mere square foot of space I'm occupying in that entire open desert. A car horn breaks the silence. I whirl around, and there, about 100 yards up the highway, a new VW van has stopped. I grab my pack and Bota bag, and, still holding on to the balloon, race to the van. A woman and her 2 children are inside. Between gasps of breath, I try to explain to her about the balloon and what's just happened. She stares at me for a moment, then motions for me to get in. "We're on our way to Denver," she says. I drop the balloon, watch it bound away into the desert waste, and hop in the van. From that moment, I become like the drifting balloon, or perhaps the balloon imparts some mysterious protective force to guide me and give me faith that all will be fine and work out in some preordained way, provided I have the faith to follow where it leads. Over the next few months, nearly every person I encounter does guide me. I follow them blindly, naively, innocently, even devoutly, like a determined pilgrim whose faith cannot be shaken. The paths lead to the Gare du Nord in Paris, where I meet Peggy Flaherty, the American art student with whom I travel for 3 days, stopping in Dijon, where she explains about the artist Claus Schluter and how he changed the architecture of his time, the end of the 14th century, by bringing new innovations of emotional gestures, expressions, and models to Gothic statuary. We camp out in the fields outside Dijon and make love in the warmth of my sleeping bag. Our separation in Valence is painful, but Peggy plants something in my mind when she says, "You have an artistic soul. You should express that part of you." I've never thought of art as an avenue to explore, a means by which to rid myself of the perplexity that possesses me so strongly, a battleground on which to confront what the military psychiatrists at the prison have so successfully convinced me of, namely, my own derangement. After Peggy's train disappears, I slump on a platform bench at the Valence train station, consumed by self-pity, weeping openly, the tears of a deep longing running freely. I relive each precious moment from the Gare du Nord and again its wondrous, fulfilling love, the first true emotion I felt in years. A part of me has disappeared on that train. All that remains is the map I hold in my hands, the map drawn by Peggy outlining all the places I should see in Europe. 4 days later, I wander through Florence, barely conscious of the history surrounding me. I pass through the Uffizi, as Peggy has recommended, and am attracted to Botticelli's paintings. I look for a long time at The Birth of Venus, and in it see Peggy's same melancholy beauty. At the Michelangelo Academy, David holds me in awe, and in that moment I know that art is the road to my own salvation. I leave Florence and live for 2 days on the trains, getting off only to buy bread and wine. I take the train ferry that crosses the strait between the Italian mainland and Sicily. Only a few peasants ride the train from Messina. About half the distance across the northern coast of Sicily, the train stops at the fishing village of Cefalù. On an impulse, I get off. The sun is high in a cloudless sky. It's very warm. The village lies at the base of a large headland. The adobe buildings are all old. The smell of salt and fish and sea fills the air. Long lines of laundry on many rooftops flap in the breeze. Copper-skinned children run laughing and shouting through the narrow, meandering streets. Many small skiffs are docked in the harbor, where weather-beaten men patiently mend their nets. A castle rests on a hill overlooking the village. Nearby is an old cathedral. I walk along the long stretch of beach outside the village for about a mile until I find a comfortable, isolated spot. The white sand shimmers under the hot sun. I wash my clothes and hang them to dry on a nearby tree. For most of the next 2 days, I lie on the beach and occasionally wade in the surf. As the sun goes down on the second day, I watch two fishermen in a dinghy gather in their nets, silhouettes against a sinking red background. I watch them for a long time while poking at my fire with a piece of driftwood. It's a peaceful evening. I'm content listening to the pounding of the surf. I hear the sound of feet trudging in the sand. I squint to see who's coming. As the figure approaches, I can make out that it's a small man who walks with a tired gait. The man stops by the fire and looks down at me. I motion the man to sit down. He has a small pack that he tosses by the fire. He sits down and crosses his legs. In the firelight, I can see him better. He has a ruddy complexion with a deep scar on his left cheek. His hair is sandy-colored and runs down the back of his neck. His clothes are tattered with many patches. He looks like a drifter whose skin is continually exposed to sun and wind. Deep wrinkles furrow his forehead. His eyes are those of a tired dog. "Do you speak English?" I ask. "A little," the man says with a heavy accent. A silence follows while he stares at the fire. "Care for some cheese?" The man nods. I slice some cheese and break off some bread. The man nibbles slowly on the food. "Some wine?" The man smiles gratefully and accepts. He holds my bota out at arm's length, tilts his head back and squeezes a long swig without spilling a drop, hands the bota back, and nods a thin smile. I take a drink. We watch the fire and listen to the surf. We continue to share the wine. "What's your name?" I ask. "Peter," the man says, still gazing at the fire. Then he shifts his gaze to me. "And you? How are you called?" "David Thompson." I pick up a piece of driftwood and poke the fire. "Do you have a home?"
"No."
"You must be from somewhere. Where were you born?" Peter looks in the distance for a moment, then looks intently into my eyes. "Yes, I come from Germany, but I cannot return."
"May I ask why not?"
Peter reaches for the bota and takes another drink, swishing it around in his mouth before swallowing. "This is good wine, my friend," he says, then changes his position to lie beside the fire with his head propped up with his right hand. He appears to be thinking about my question. The fire begins to die. Peter gets up, shakes sand off his clothes. "I will bring more wood." I lie back down, my hands folded and supporting the back of my head. I watch the stars. It's a clear night. The moon is in the quarter phase. Peter returns with an armload of driftwood and throws two pieces on the fire before sitting down again. He looks at me briefly, then says, "A long time ago, I put a knife in a man. It was a stupid fight about a woman. I am lucky. I did not kill the man because the woman was not worth the price of the trouble. I went to prison, but I escaped. I cannot go back." We stare at the fire. "I've been to prison," I say.
"I know."
"How do you know?" You were quiet. You were alone.
How long have you traveled like this?
I don't know. A long time.
Through many countries?
Yes.
Do you have some destination?
In winter, I am in the south. In summer, I am in the north.
It must get lonely.
Yes, very lonely. But it is the way I choose.
I throw some more wood on the fire. It responds with a loud crackle. The new warmth feels good as the night is cooling. I crawl into my sleeping bag. Peter brings out a tattered blanket from his pack and wraps it around his shoulders. We watch the red-yellow flames of the fire jump and disappear into the night air.
Some more wine?
I offer the bota to Peter.
No, you must save it for yourself. My head is good.
Where did you come from today?
From the church in the village.
Peter points toward the village.
The priest is very kind. He gave me food and drink as you did, my friend. If you have hunger, you can always go to the church.
It's not always that way in America.
I do not know about America.
Neither do I, really. I sigh.
You did a crime against the great America?
Peter stirs the fire coals with a stick. I prop my head with my right hand and think for a moment.
I refused to fight in Vietnam. I didn't think the war was a just one. There were many like me who didn't want to fight. It's been an ugly thing, something that divided my country's people. There were many who were put in prison for their convictions.
Politics are evil. Are you now running from America?
I'm not sure what I'm running from. It's just that I don't feel a part of America anymore, and now I'm searching for something better. I'm very confused right now.
Have you a woman?
Peter looks directly at me.
There was one not too long ago that I felt strongly about, but it was only temporary. We were traveling different paths.
Peter leans forward and says, "Go back to her. This is not a good life. You will only find what you seek in a good woman. Do not become like me. It is not good for one who is young."
When I wake the next morning, the coals from the fire are dead. Peter is gone. I pack my things and walk back into the village. I board the first train to Messina, settling in an empty compartment, not knowing where to go next, thinking only of Peggy as the poverty-stricken countryside flashes by the window. My head came back to the present. On the table in front of me were two more chess pieces. I picked them up and stared at them.
What should I name these players? The two alienated wanderers?
I wondered for a moment if my life had not actually become what Peter warned me against. Like him, I'd wandered the world for years, but in the end I did heed his words. I found my woman. I heard Pablo's voice behind me.
Go ahead, play another game. It might be interesting.
I turned around, but saw only the back of a waiter darting inside the shop. I pulled the chessboard out of my tote bag and placed it on the table. I put my new pieces into action and watched them go into a variety of other life directions for a while, but soon grew bored. I drained the rest of the beer, paid the bill, and went back to the hotel room. I felt a little sad, so I'd stretched out on the bed until Cowdy returned about 6:30.
"How are you doing, honey-chan? How are the legs?"
She put the two bags she was holding on a chair and sat down next to me on the bed.
I had a good nap, then went out for a while. The legs are hanging in there okay. How was your day?
Great. I rented a bicycle and went to 3 museums. I looked at a lot of paintings and I learned about Hans Holbein the Younger today at the Kunstmuseum. All the other painters' paintings seemed like two-dimensional cartoons until I saw Hans Holbein's. His portraits were so detailed that it was like they were alive. Really fascinating.
She had a happy, satisfied look on her face.
Did you hear about the earthquake in Turkey?
Yes, it makes me very sad. I told some Swiss people today that I really admired them because when Kobe had the earthquake, the Swiss were the first ones to help. They sent us sniffer dogs faster than the Japanese government responded. They're probably already sending dogs to Turkey, too.
Yeah, I remember that.
Basel is really a beautiful city. I would never have thought of visiting Basel if I hadn't come here with you.
Cowardy rested her hand on my foot.
Are you looking forward to seeing Undine tomorrow?
Yes, I am. We'll call her later tonight to make sure of what time to meet. I just wish our timing had been better. There are too many strange things happening on this trip.
Thomas's death, the earthquake, all those signs like the one at the Taipei airport that said our plane left at 1313 from gate 13. It seems almost like someone or something is constantly trying to warn us about something.
Oh, don't be so superstitious, Cowardy said in mock amusement. Are you hungry? Let's go eat.
We went downstairs and had supper in the hotel restaurant. Later, I called Undine. We agreed to meet at her shop at 2 o'clock the next day.
Chapter 7. Tram number 6 took us to the German border, which we passed through without having to show our passports. For a moment, I flashed back to 1977, when Hassan met me at the same place, and we later met Thomas at a downtown bar, had a few beers, then went to Thomas's place in the hills. I remembered how energetic, vital, and youthful Thomas had been, and those sparkling eyes. Cowardy and I caught a bus that took us to the Lorach station. It was easy to find Undine's carpet shop. There was a big poster of an Afghan on the window. We were early for the appointment, so Marian prepared a couple of seats and some tea for us. The shop was small, with a lot of trinkets and pictures on the walls and shelves. There were a few carpets on display, but most were stored in a back storage room. A few minutes later, Undine showed up. She was bigger than I remembered, and her long blonde hair was changing color. Her face lit up when she saw us. Undine and I hugged each other tightly, laughing and crying simultaneously, and I introduced her to Kaori, who stuck out her hand to shake, but was suddenly engulfed in an embrace that left her breathless. It seemed as if we had stayed in touch for all these years. We sat down around the office desk. Undine reached into a drawer, pulled out an old picture of Thomas, and gave it to me. He was sitting cross-legged in an Afghan tea shop, holding a cup of tea and smiling. He looked exactly as I remembered him. I told her some of the stories of my adventures. I took up a good hour or so recounting the meeting of Hassan and Atallah in Paris, my memories of the time at Thomas's, the subsequent journey with Hassan to Iran, the month with Atallah in Afghanistan, and the horrors of my time in India. The story seemed to touch a spark in Undine that took her back to better times with Thomas. As she listened, she became increasingly more animated in her responses and eager to tell her own stories. I was also anxious to know what happened to Thomas. At one point I asked, "So, how did you and Thomas meet in the beginning?" "I was 17," Dean said. "Just there was a day after my, how do you say, I was a decorator, and after you finish learning this you make a, what do you make, qualification. But you have to do this and then this is finished and you say, let's make a party. So we went down to a little discotheque we had here in town and I met Thomas on this day." Undine closed her eyes for a moment, opened them, and leaned forward, her arms resting on the desk. "I met Thomas, and I was dancing with him. He took me in my arm from the first moment. I was normally..." Undine made a gesture for being shy. "But I let it. He could do it with me." A smile spread across Undine's face. "It was okay, and from this moment I loved this boy." Kaori and I looked at each other and smiled. "I was not living with him then. I was 17, and it was January 66. Yes, January 66 I met him. And then I lived together with him after our first trip to the East. I was 21 then. That was 1969, I think." "Were you interested in the East before you met Thomas?" I asked. "No," Undine said, her eyes growing wide. "And him also not. No, no." "How did he become so interested? I remember vaguely he told some stories about going to San Francisco," I said. "He was in San Francisco." "And he was around the Jefferson airplane?"
"Yes, yes. He got two cats from the Jefferson airplane. From the group. Two cats. Kitties." Undine held her hands apart to show the size of the kittens.
"Was he working for them?"
"No. Wait a minute." Undine waved her arm in the air. "When was this? When was this? In 69, maybe. In 69, we went to the East. We went to the East. It was 71 when he was in California, because I met him there. It was after our trip to the East where he bought these first carpets." Undine motioned toward the carpets surrounding us. "And we were in a carpet shop in Kabul. Then there was this French guy talking to them, French friends, and he said, this carpet is this and this, and this and this and this is in the carpet. And, you know, he could read carpets, this French guy. Because he was a long time in the East, he could read carpets. And Thomas's ears got like this. Undine put her hands over her ears and pretended her ears were growing bigger. It was interesting somehow, and Thomas's ears got like this because he was wanting to know things all the time. What does it mean when you want to know everything? What's the meaning in English?
Curious, I suppose, I said.
The telephone rang. It seemed there were many people calling to give their condolences. Undine finally put the phone down and turned once again to us.
So look, our story, it started. Going to the East, it was 1969. In 1969, we were with some friends and we heard a lot of Goa, India. A lot of people went there. So Thomas was always, yeah, you know.
Undine put her hands by her ears and smiled.
Listening with big ears, Cowardy said and laughed.
Going on, you know, going on. So we planned to go. 2 cars and 7 people. We planned. In the end, it turned out 1 car and 4 people. There was Thomas, me, and 2 friends. And one of the friends was auto mechanic. So he could manage the car all the time. So we bought for some 1,000, 3,000 marks or something, an old Mercedes 190. And, this Mercedes, the guy who sold us the Mercedes, he said, it's about this and this kind of kilometers. But in the end, it turned out it were more than 200,000 kilometers more on the machine. But we still went on. We still went on. So we drove down from Germany and all through Turkey, Bulgaria, the same road as you. Through Turkey, then Iran. In those times, the streets were not flat. They were like...
Undine bent over to touch the floor and make more gestures showing potholes and rising hills.
So, in Iran, we had hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. We were sitting in this car. It was hot outside. And we were covered with dust, she said dramatically, enunciating each syllable. Full of dust.
Undine paused for a moment, closed her eyes again, seemingly reliving the memory, then continued.
Full of dust, kilometer for kilometer. We were sleeping on the road. We were sleeping when somebody said, come here, you can stay in the home, for somewhere, you know. And we went to Afghanistan, came to Kandahar. And in Kandahar, it was like, wow, a different feeling than Iran. It was the first town after the border.
Do you mean Herat? I asked.
Oh, Herat. Oh, I'm sorry, Herat. Not Kandahar. Kandahar is going to Pakistan. In Herat, it was hot. And all the flies and all this, you know. And I remember we were sitting in a restaurant, first floor somewhere, and we ordered Coca-Cola, and they brought us Coca-Cola in the original Coca-Cola bottle. But it was just water, colored water. And we all got so sick.
Some customers came in. Undine excused herself and got up to help them. When they left the shop, she sat down again and continued.
And we all got sick. There were a lot of flies and so on. And we went on to Kabul. In Kabul, we were all lying down, just giving up in stomach problems, she said, putting special emphasis on the first syllable of stomach. And we said, let's go away from this Afghanistan. So when we got a bit better, we went to Pakistan. From Pakistan, we went to India, Delhi. We drove a lot of times at night because it was too hot in the daytime.
You didn't know Ataullah at that time? I asked.
No. It was our first trip. We didn't know Ataullah. And in Delhi, I remember coming into Delhi in middle of the night. We thought, oh, let's sleep outside, because we don't know where to find hotel and so on. And we went on a little hill. We went on a little hill and we always changed. 2 were always sleeping in the car and 2 outside. It was Thomas and my turn to sleep in the car, luckily. And in the early morning when the sun came up, when the light came up a bit, these 2 others knocked on the windows.
Undine was getting excited again, her voice rising.
Hey, let's go away. We, you know, and we were standing in the middle of a shitting place from Delhi people, you know, on a hill. Everybody was there sitting with a little cube of metal, water, and they were shitting, talking to each other, and we stood in the middle of this. I woke up and these 2 were sleeping outside. We were so tired and this was the first impression of Delhi.
Undine let loose with an infectious and deep belly laugh. It took a minute or so for us to recover.
Oh, my God, Undine said, wiping tears from her eyes.
But from Delhi we went up north and went up to Kathmandu, and in Kathmandu was a nice festival going on. In the middle of the city. What was it called? I always had it in my head, but now I forgot the name. Inkru something festival. There was a little girl who was just making like a little god, you know. They drove her to town, and she was pretty and well-dressed and in a big car. I've seen a documentary on this, Cowardy said. Yeah, and you know, and we just came in when it was just happening, you know. So we came into a place that was full of thousands and thousands of Nepalese people, women and men and children and nicely dressed, and we just came there. That must have been something to see, Cowardy said, leaning forward in her chair. Indrajatra Festival, Indrajatra Festival. And we made a lot of pictures. We have beautiful pictures from there. Yeah, and we stayed some days in Kabul, in Kathmandu, and out in the valley. Wanted to go to the Chinese border, and we drove there. I got really sick because of the high, you know, and sick outside. We were lying down a long time again. I don't remember, you know. And then we drove back to Calcutta, back from Nepal, after what, I don't know how long.
You went to Nepal by car? I asked.
By car, everything by car. But this was the nice experience, because you came together with the people when you go by car. I remember on the road somewhere, we asked people if we could sleep somewhere inside, and they said yes, and we had to go up this little tiny stick with legs.
A ladder? I said, making a motion of climbing.
A ladder, you know, wood ladder. And they had chicken up there, and they got their broom and made the dust just like this.
Undine made a vigorous gesture for sweeping.
The dust was like this going everywhere, and you couldn't see anything. The chicken went away, and they said, you could sleep here.
We had to hold our sides with laughter.
Something like this, you know. And they were cooking with tea and with little lamps in the night and things like this, you know. Nice, you know.
Undine paused for a moment, a wide smile on her face.
This first trip was one of the best trips we made. We were on the road about 8 months. Coming back from Nepal, we went then to Calcutta, and Calcutta is a really heavy city.
Undine shook her head slowly. Yeah, I said, you have to be ready for Calcutta. Delhi is pretty bad, but...
Oh, God, yes. And we were not in our heads ready for nothing. We just went on, you know. We didn't know about India. Maybe Thomas, but not me. I had no ideas about as a religion at this time. I was 20 years old. Hinduism was so far away, and Buddhism was so far away, and all this, you know.
But those things kind of stimulate your interest after you return to study and read about the places you experienced, I said. Undine lowered her voice, reached over, touched my arm, and said,
But I tell you something. For me, it was like I was somewhere out of everything.
Yeah, out of this world, I know, I said excitedly. Cowardy was wide-eyed and, in a sense, out of her conversational league now as she watched Undine and me go deeper and deeper into our Asian memories.
Just the smell and the dust and this many, many, many people in India,
Undine flailed her arms about.
And you never be alone. All these people around you, you know. It's a new experience for Europeans, you know.
And you walk around like this all day long. I got up and walked around the room with my jaw wide open.
Yeah, yes, somehow, India. The first time in India is like this. And also many, many experiences of being afraid, you know, after not knowing things that goes on.
Fear of the unknown, maybe, I said.
Yeah, fear of the unknown, right. We saw a funeral outside Benares where they burn people. I didn't know much about it. I was standing there like this.
Undine made the same face I'd made.
And we met a Buddhist guy, a monk. He was an old guy, and he said he met Gandhi or something, or I don't remember. Anyway, some important man he met, and he told us about it. And then he took us to, in Benares, he took us to his monastery, and we could sleep there. We could sleep there in a little room with two wooden table, and there was the beds, you know. So we got our sleeping bags on the wooden table, and I could sleep all night. And early morning we went out down to the Ganges and took a boat early morning and saw all the burnings outside.
Undine looked away for a moment. Her lips pursed. The cremations, I asked.
Cremations, and this city, Benares, Calcutta and Benares. If you have seen these two cities, she said in a low, respectful whisper, it's just too much. It's just too much. You just smell the dead in Benares. And then you see, after burning them, they get into...
The river, I said, Boschian imagery raging in my head.
Into the Ganges. They put everything into the Ganges. And even if it's not gone, you see everything. It's too much.
The pace of Undine's narrative picked up again.
And just coming out of here, you have no idea about the East and see this.
I was the same way in Delhi. I was on the edge of my seat now, too.
You know what it is? After coming home after this trip, you had to go on thinking all the time about it. Because when you were there, it was just too much. This I cannot tell you in English. You understand?
Undine looked deeply into my eyes.
Yes, I do. The same thing happened to me. When I went back to the United States, it took me maybe 3 years. I understand. Yeah. Right.
It was a reverse culture shock. People were living their lives and I'd been to hell and back, and I wanted to explain every single detail of what I'd seen and experienced to every single person I met.
You cannot tell because nobody understands. Nobody understands, Undine said sadly.
And I started drinking heavily after that.
Yeah, nobody understands. It was like when people were in Vietnam and they came back and want to talk. I think it's the same, you know. It's the same thing. The other people cannot know.